Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 12th of March, these are our main stories. The US State Department says it's trying to expedite the deployment of a UN-backed multinational police force to Haiti, where gang violence is dragging the country into anarchy. Ukraine's president says 2,000 kilometres of defensive fortifications are being constructed to counter Russia's advance. Also in this podcast,
the notion that a great collector suddenly discovers great caches of works of the Russian avant-garde hiding under people's bed in the Belarusian forest. It's right up there with the Earth is Flat.
The fake pieces of Russian art that have been sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. The US State Department says it's leading efforts to help the deployment of a UN-backed, thousand-strong multinational police force in Haiti, where heavily armed gangs have stepped up a campaign of violence. A State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, said the US was in contact with the government in Kenya, the country which would lead the mission. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in Kingston in Jamaica for an emergency meeting of leaders from Caribbean nations, where a plan to speed up a political transition in Haiti is being discussed.
The proposal that is on the table that CARICOM has developed over the past several days in consultation with Haitian stakeholders and consultation with the United States would expedite a political transition through the creation of a broad-based, independent presidential college to steer the country toward the deployment of a multinational security support mission and free and fair elections, and that's what I expect the Secretary will be discussing.
Henry Isaacs is a journalist in Port-au-Prince in Haiti.
The gangs have rather calmed down in the last few hours. It's very fragile. I think everybody's waiting for what comes out of Kingston, but we're running low on gas, on oil, food, water. It's a situation that risks becoming very difficult. Of course, organizations such as the WFP, the UNICEF, are all raising alarms about how the situation may aggravate in the coming hours and days. So that's why everybody's hopeful for a resolution or some sort of path forward, at least politically, to start and address the security situation. But people are also very realistic about the possible outcomes as the political situation remains very complicated. It's unclear if they will find one common ground to help the country get out of that political void that we're facing right now.
Henry Isaacs in Haiti. As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, the president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says his country is constructing defensive fortifications 2,000 kilometres long and three lines deep. He called it a massive task, but said the pace of construction is good. Here's Danny Eberhardt.
Ukraine, it appears, is adapting its military strategy following an ineffectual counteroffensive last year and then recent losses of territory during sustained Russian offensives. Mr. Zelensky called shoring up defences a massive task. He spoke on social media of lines 2,000 kilometres long, but appeared to suggest a much shorter distance to the French broadcaster BFM TV. He told it that the situation facing his country's troops was now much better than over the last 3 months, claiming, without providing evidence, that Russian advances had been halted.
Danny Eberhard. The trial of a British hedge fund trader, which is being watched closely by tax authorities around the world, has opened in Denmark. Sanjay Shah is charged with defrauding the Danish Treasury out of almost $2 billion by claiming tax refunds on the trading of shares, a strategy that's become known as a Cum-Ex scheme. He denies any wrongdoing. I asked our international business correspondent, Theo Leggett, to tell us more about the man at the centre of the trial.
Well, he's a colourful man, Val. He's a British trader who founded a London-based, initially, hedge fund called Solo Capital. And then he moved to Dubai, where he gained a reputation for hosting extravagant parties. He led an autism charity that held really high-profile fundraising events with very much a larger-than-life character. But he's also been implicated in a massive Europe-wide trading scam called Camex. And he's on trial in Denmark, accused of defrauding the country's government of some $1.8 billion in lost taxes between 2012 and 2015 through this complex trading fraud.
You say it's complex. Can you describe it in simple language about what it actually means?
I'll do my best. It's a tax fraud that initially began in Germany in the early years of the century, and it involved shares being sold just before the payment of a dividend, then those shares actually being delivered and the transaction completed just after the dividend payment. And this created confusion over who actually owned the shares when the dividend was paid. And the net result was that two parties, the buyer and the seller, could both claim a refund on a tax payment that had only been made once. And that's the basis of it. And this scam was elaborated. You had enormous structures where huge amounts of shares were being traded time and time again with the sole purpose of getting multiple tax refunds on a tax that had only been paid once. It was prevalent in Germany initially, then they changed the law there, so it moved through Denmark, France, Belgium, Italy and Austria. Much of it was orchestrated from London, although the British Exchequer wasn't really a victim. And those implicated, they've included US pension funds, German banks, international lawyers and many, many others. And it's thought to have cost governments across Europe at least 10 billion euros.
And this man is not the only one charged over this, is he?
No, in Denmark, there are, I think, 9 people, US citizens, British citizens, who are also being investigated. But Sanjay Shah is being portrayed by prosecutors as the kingpin, one of the real leaders. He's been attracting all of the focus. And don't forget, Denmark's been building up to this for years. It's a very complex subject. This is not the first legal action it's taken. It did, for example, try and pursue some 100 financial institutions through London's High Court for repayment of lost tax. In the case of Mr. Shah, he'd been identified by whistleblowers as a key figure in the trade. But before he could be tried by Denmark, he needed to be extradited. So there's an extradition battle. Eventually, Dubai agreed to him being sent to Denmark. And the case against him, of course, by its very nature, is very complex. So we shouldn't be surprised it's taken quite a few years to get to this stage.
So this court case is happening in Denmark now. You've mentioned other countries involved. Is this worldwide? Is this something lots of nations are going to be looking at closely?
Well, the fraud was largely perpetrated on European governments. So it's in Europe that we're seeing the attention of prosecutors on a number of people, many of them in the US, some in London. Why I think this case is key is because it's so high profile and it's a test of the legal arguments. Mr. Shah says he didn't do anything wrong, that the Danes don't understand their own tax laws. So arguments of that nature will be tested. If he is successfully prosecuted, it will certainly energise other European governments to prosecute more people allegedly involved in the Camex scam.
Theo Leggett. 5 skiers who disappeared during a storm in the Swiss Alps have been found dead, as rescue teams described finding an ugly picture when the bodies were found. As we record this podcast, teams are still searching for another person from the group who all went missing around Tête Blanche Mountain on Saturday, near the Matterhorn Mountain that straddles the border between Switzerland and Italy. Our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folks, told me more.
We know that they set off from Zermatt on Saturday morning to do a very well-known, challenging, but fine if you're an experienced ski tourer route from Zermatt to a place called Arolla, up to an altitude of well over 3,500 metres. Now, I think the weather was quite good when they set off, but they were absolutely overwhelmed by weather conditions that even the rescue services described as catastrophic, with heavy snow and very high winds. We're going to hear from Anjan Truffer. He's a head of Zermatt's Mountain Rescue Service, and he can tell us a bit more about what actually happened.
Yes, you can imagine. You go skiing and suddenly the weather changes and it becomes bad. You can't see anything anymore, and then come high winds. You are up there in a so-called whiteout and you lose orientation without the necessary equipment.
And Imogen, we understand they tried to dig a cave for shelter.
That's right. And in fact, Mr. Truffer, who you heard from there, I actually talked to him last night before he was one of the people who actually sadly found the five people dead. He had told me then that it's a good possibility if they have dug this snow hole, then they could survive. This happened a few years ago with some German ski tourers on the same route, and they managed to stay warm by digging the snow hole. This time, it appears that they tried but weren't able to do it. And the conditions were, as I said, very, very difficult. Minus 16, but also with winds on top of that of up to 100 kilometres an hour. So the wind chill factor. And they were really very high up where things went wrong for them.
So what about the chances of finding this missing person alive?
To be honest, I think the rescue services would say at this point, possibly not very high. But, you know, as they say, hope is the last thing that people give up. So a very, very risky rescue operation and very, still very challenging conditions, still windy, still cold. At least the visibility is a little bit better.
Imogen, folks, it's 8 months before the presidential election in America, and the rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump is already in full swing. Both men could formally clinch their party's nomination this week, and they've headed straight for the most marginal state in the country, Georgia. Joe Biden won it last time by just 0.3%. That's fewer than 12,000 votes. But that victory in Georgia was due in large part to almost 90% of the sizable African-American community there backing him. Yet there are worrying signs for Democrats, as support among black voters has shown a significant dip in recent polls. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue reports.
Going door to door in this Atlanta suburb, voting rights advocates are testing the mood among African American voters for the upcoming election.
Are you going to vote this upcoming election?
Wasn't looking at doing it.
Was it?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It's an attitude members of the New Georgia Project are trying to combat, and they're finding frustration with the Democrats on the doorstep. Jacqueline Howard is a local teacher.
The Republicans, they can say one thing and people will catch on to it, you know, and it sticks. And so I want us to have more one-liners. I do want more aggression.
88% of black voters in Georgia supported Joe Biden in 2020. But some surveys show that as many as one in four could now back Donald Trump. Karen Blair from the New Georgia Project says the cost of living is a big factor.
People do talk about the price of gas, the price of food, and we absolutely think and demand that more be done from this administration and from the next to address those economic concerns that people have.
Across town, the Cascade Roller Skating Rink is a big community venue for African Americans. It's also used at elections for Get Out the Vote organisers. The owner, Greg Alexander, says few are excited about a Trump-Biden rematch.
A lot of people in my community kind of feel like we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Biden is a good president. He's not a great president. And a lot of us are concerned about his age.
Look, I'm not a young guy. That's no secret. But here's the deal. I understand how to get things done for the American people.
The Biden campaign has sought to address the age issue head on, with the first of a number of adverts in the coming weeks. Here in Georgia, his focus was squarely on voters of color.
And we're here to say simple thank you, thank you, thank you.
2020 was the first time in more than a quarter of a century that Democrats won the presidential election year. And with more than a third of Georgia's voters coming from the African-American community, Joe Biden knows he needs that support to win and cannot take it for granted. From the lakes of
Minnesota. 70 miles up the road, Donald Trump was making his own pitch to Georgia's black voters. Some recent polls have shown him with an overall lead here, despite facing 13 criminal charges in the state for alleged attempts to overturn the result in 2020.
I did more for black people than any president other than Abraham Lincoln. It's true.
The road to the White House runs straight through battlegrounds like Georgia and a handful of other key swing states. Expect to see many more of these head-to-head clashes between the two candidates in the coming months.
Gary O'Donoghue. Still to come.
It's in all our interests to protect the quality of the written word and to protect the quality of the imagination.
The authors whose work is being used to develop AI without their permission.
Hi, I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're the hosts of a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Where to Be a Woman. So, what's the podcast about, Saatchi?
It's all about where in the world women are living their best lives, what female wellness looks like globally, and what the rest of us may be able to learn from it.
And where can people find it?
Just search for Where to Be a Woman wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.
In India, a new citizenship law is coming into place, which critics are calling anti-Muslim. The law grants fast-tracked Indian nationality to Hindus and five other minority religions who've sought sanctuary in India from three neighbouring countries, but not if they're Muslim. The law was passed in 2019, but has been delayed due to protests. Our South Asia editor and Barasan Itharajan told me more.
The Citizenship Amendment Act, which is a very controversial legislation that allows Indian nationality to Hindus, Parsis, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jains and Christians and who fled from countries like Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan, only these three countries, so that they can get the India citizenship. Now, this is controversial because it has excluded one of the other religions, Muslims and Islam. So now that has triggered a lot of anger within India because many people fear this is only a precursor to something more sinister by the Hindu nationalist BJP government in Delhi, because then they will introduce the National Register for Citizens that will have an impact on the country's 200 million strong Muslim minority. However, the Indian government strongly rejects these allegations and says that these are persecuted minorities, these six people, these six groups of religious minorities from these three countries, they needed protection, and that is why we have implemented, and we are not taking away citizenship from anyone. So when this act was passed, when the law was passed in 2019, that sparked nationwide protests. You know, students, political parties, activists, they joined, and during the clashes, about 100 people were killed and hundreds more were injured. So the government was basically extending this law without implementing it, without announcing these rules, what makes them eligible to become Indian citizens. And now, just weeks before India's national elections, this has been announced, once again triggering a lot of concerns.
Well, it's triggering concerns not just in India, but also elsewhere, because the United Nations is saying this law is discriminatory.
When it was passed, there were widespread condemnation and criticism from the UN and other human rights groups. And it's also many Indian activists were pointing out, political parties were pointing out, India is a secular democratic country. And you cannot have one religion outside saying we are going to give nationality based on religion. So that is not in the constitution. So this violates constitution, and that is why this plan has to be shelved. And they also point out that this is a broader agenda of making India more Hindu-centric. And that's why the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi is implementing. But the government is again flatly rejecting these accusations and insists that it was only to give those persecuted religious minorities from these three countries.
And Barasan Etharajan. Catfishing involves the creation of a fake identity online, then using the deception usually to mislead a victim into an internet-based romantic relationship or to commit financial fraud. Now a man from County Down in Northern Ireland has pleaded guilty to the manslaughter of a young girl who killed herself after he blackmailed her online. Alexander McCartney, who's 25, has also admitted more than 180 charges relating to the systematic online abuse of children using catfishing. Our correspondent Jennifer O'Leary has been following the case at Belfast Crown Court.
Alexander McCartney did not have to leave his home in a rural part of Northern Ireland in order to abuse children. His cunning took the form of catfishing, using a fake identity to trick people into online friendships for malevolent purposes. For years, he deceived children into sending him sexual images of themselves, which he then used to threaten them, saying he would upload their images online if they did not do what he asked. He was himself a teenager in 2018 when a girl under the age of 13 took her own life after being blackmailed by him. He was only stopped after police in Scotland, acting on a report in the same year, 2018, that another girl who was 12 was being blackmailed, triggered an investigation that uncovered the scale of his activities. Thousands of child abuse images were found on devices seized from his home. His manipulation spanned the globe, with victims identified in both New Zealand and the United States. McCartney has been in custody since 2019. He previously pleaded guilty to 185 charges over a period from 2013 to 2019, involving more than 60 victims, and will be sentenced in May.
Jennifer O'Leary. The Publishers Association has written to the world's biggest tech companies, warning them if they want to use the work of British authors to build their large language AI models, then they must pay them. Three American authors filed a class action against the chip company NVIDIA on Friday, accusing it of using their copyrighted books without permission to train its Nemo AI platform. Sarah Montague asked the crime writer Val McDermott how she found out her works had been used by artificial intelligence.
I was sent a link to a website that has been clocking the way that the texts that have been used in this way, and 147 pieces of my work, including every one of my published novels, has been used to train AI models.
Would, for example, I notice it because there would be some phrasing that you used that would pop up when I asked a question of a large language model?
Yes, I would. Yes, you would. I mean, if you asked a large language model to write a Karen Piri story, for example, using one of my lead characters, you would have something that was recognisably Karen Piri, although it wouldn't be anything like the quality of storytelling I would like to say that I produce.
What powers do you have? Because it's obviously there are increasing number. There are authors in the States who have been pursuing this. And now, of course, publishing houses here who have been getting increasingly vocal.
Yeah, I think the only redress we have at this point, since the tech companies are not particularly willing to engage with meaningful discussions about it, is to go down the legal route, which unfortunately will take time and be even more expensive. I mean, it's in all our interests to protect the quality of the written word, and to protect the quality of the imagination, which is ultimately what this is about. You know, my work is the product of years of practice, but it's also the product of my imagination. I have come up with stories that nobody else has come up with in quite this way. And I don't see why that should be available to be ripped off in this way.
Is it too late?
I don't know. I hope it isn't too late, because I think if we go down this road, what we will ultimately see is an impoverishment of the culture. It will sideline authors who are effectively no longer needed, and thus ultimately we end up with a much poorer culture. We end up with a much poorer set of imaginative options. I think if you put ideas, broad ideas, into AI models, what you get are poor replicas at the moment, and that will improve, obviously, as the machines learn better from everyone else's work. But I would like to think that the human element will be missing.
Except, isn't this the direction we're headed? It's, for example, if they were prepared to pay you, wouldn't that solve your particular issue?
Well, it would solve it on the surface, in that at least authors would be being recompensed for their work. The route we're going down with AI model is the idea that you no longer have to pay authors to produce something in the first place. You just rip off everything that's been done before, feed it through the computer, put a different name into it, a different style into it, you know, say something, write something in the style of Val McDermott and Ali Smith, and you get something different.
How serious a moment do you think this is for writers?
I think it's a very serious moment. If you create a culture where it's no longer economically viable for people to be writers, why would they write?
Are we really at that point?
I don't want to be a sort of doomsayer, but the bottom line is, if you're not being paid for what you do, then you're doing it in the interstices of what you are doing in order to make a living. And so you don't have the kind of focus, the kind of practice, the kind of day-to-day learning your craft that good writers aspire to.
The author, Val McDermid. And the BBC contacted OpenAI, Google DeepMind and Meta for a response, but didn't hear back. And finally, more fakes than originals. That's how one expert has described the market for Russian art in a new documentary here on the BBC World Service. Hunting down an elusive art dealer who began selling paintings in the early 2000s, the programme reveals fake pieces of work that have been sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Grigor Atanasian compiled this report.
9:30 on a summer evening.
An auction in London in the 1950s, and it's a scramble for an avant-garde Russian masterpiece once banned by Stalin.
Sold for more than £500,000 in 1 hour, 2 minutes. They belong to the Guggenheim Foundation.
The demand for these radical modern pieces after World War II also brought a wave of forgeries, and it still fools buyers today. James Butterwick has spent much of his life in Russia and Ukraine as an art dealer. He is one of the outspoken few to publicly question the true value of these works, including by a Russian-Israeli art dealer called Leonid Zaks.
The Zaks collection, it's Disneyland, isn't it? The notion that a great collector suddenly discovers great caches of works of the Russian avant-garde hiding under people's bed in the Belarusian forest. It's right up there with The Earth is Flat.
Leonid Zaks, owner of the Zaks collection, which has pieces hanging in European and American museums and in Beatrice Gampel's home. Her parents bought several pieces from the Zaks collection. Beatrice's family was sold a piece supposedly by the Russian master Lisitsky, a heavyweight of modern art.
After he died, when we had the first inheritors meetings, when one of the experts said that a whole range of paintings were dubious, we were absolutely shocked and we didn't believe it to start with.
James looked over the painting carefully. It did not look good. So we went to Hephaestus Analytical, a lab which specializes in spotting fakes using AI. Denis Moiseev is its founder.
On the simplified graph, it's quite clear that the magenta line representing the subject painting is really far away from the expected distribution of what we'd expect from a authentic Lisitsky. Therefore, I'm afraid the painting is a forgery.
This was backed up by more traditional scientific analysis that found modern fibers within the paint. But what about the man behind the collection, Leonid Zaks? I spent months tracking him down across Europe and the Middle East. The trail went cold, until finally, out of the blue, he wanted to talk. I asked Mr. Zaks where he got his paintings from. He told me his late mother had given him the paintings and insisted they were genuine, and he had no reason to question their provenance. Beatrice now has her answer. The family's painting is worthless.
Grigor Atanasian, and you can hear the full documentary on the BBC World Service YouTube page. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.